Normal. Para X. The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual host and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Para X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
Stirring the Cauldron on the Para X Radio Network. And now, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
Merry meet everybody. And welcome to Stirring the Cauldron. Tonight we're going to be talking about energy magic of the vampire with my guest Don Webb. Now, Don joined the Temple of Set in 1989, where he served as a high priest for 6 years, and he also teaches horror writing at UCLA Extension School, and is the author of several books on the left-handed path practice and philosophy, including Overthrowing the Old Gods. If you're listening to the show live, questions and comments from the chat room are always welcome, and to be in chat, you can find us at paraxradionetwork.com. Don, hi, and thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me. You have a wonderful show.
Oh, thanks. And this is going to be a wonderful show, too. One of the wonderful shows, because it's something new, really eye-opening and thought-provoking. And let's start out. I mean, you're the master, a master of the Order of the Vampire within the Temple of Set. And for those who may not be familiar with the temple, can you tell us a little bit about it?
The temple is a left-hand path organization. Now, the left-hand path is the path of non-union. In most religions, the goal is to become one with the Godhead, to return to the divine source, however you may conceive of this. In the left-hand path, the idea is to become an individual, independent, immortal essence, who is no doubt a friend of the God, but is not part of the God. The left-hand path is a path of spiritual descent, meaning a lot of our symbols involve reversing the forms of the conventional religion that we came in from. The most common way that people think of the left-hand path in English-speaking countries is Satanism, but that's a very limiting term, because that assumes that it just means, oh, we're going to make fun of Christianity. It just means that we can break with conventional systems of thought and belief as we seek our own independence and power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking about that too when I was reading about left-handed path, because I know a couple of Satanists and they're, you know, always talking about their left-handed path. And, you know, so people might be thinking that they're one and the same, that vampire magic and the church is different than, is the same as the Satanists. So glad you cleared it up. I was curious.
One thing I want to point out about vampire magic is that anyone, regardless of your spiritual inclination, can do it. And it's very important, as you begin to get good at it anyway, to have a very strong sense of what your ethics are. Because if you find that you can do things that the average humans around you can't do, that does promote a lot of ethical questions.
Mm-hmm. It would. So vampire magic, kind of in a nutshell, what does it entail? How is it different from other forms of magic?
There's a couple of things I want to point out. Number one, although ritual and ceremony can be helpful, and I certainly give some rituals in the book, it is not done usually in a ritual context. It's usually done between one human and other human or humans. It involves drawing in, exchanging energy with other humans. It also means that you should be able to store your energy and make strong and clear decisions about how you use your energy. In many ways, human beings, as I'm sure all of your listeners are aware, we swim in a great sea of energy all the time. And we're aware all the time in all of our experiences, whether we're gaining or losing energy. We're even aware that some people, and I'll talk about this later when I talk about psychic vampires, there are people that just draw energy away from us and don't give anything. Vampiric magic begins with becoming aware of energy flow, becoming better at energy flow, and deciding what energies to take in, and, just as importantly, what energies to not take in.
Mm-hmm. You know, I also noticed there's some similarities in that some of the deities that you call down and use work, like Bridget and I think Hecate, is the same that most other practices do too. So there is a difference, but there are some similarities, right?
Well, there's definitely similarities in that these archetypes that appeal to people that begin to seek their own path are both dark and light, often deal with ecstasy. I mean, Bridget is the perfect example of the ecstatic goddess, and she can draw her energy from warfare or poetry or sex. Hecate of the Crossroads is a wonderful example because so much of her worship has always come from the danger of nighttime, the going out in a way away from the city when only the moon is your companion, and finding the crossroads to invoke her. That requires a lot of bravery, and it's very emotional.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I think it's just a whole thing that we're all different, but we're all the same, in a sense. In not necessarily in belief systems, but in belief in what we're doing and how we're doing it, and it overlaps, I think, at times. So, you know, I don't think there's that big great wall in between us as much as some people might think.
I would agree. I think that one of the most important things is to look at commonalities in spiritual and magical practice. That doesn't mean that you're going to say, all right, I'm going to do everything that this person does, or that they should do what I do. I really hate the idea of converting someone. But it does mean that we should be aware that we all have similar deep goals. You know, we all love our families. We all have a love for the natural world around us. We're all quite confused at ourselves because one of the things that society does, it takes away a lot of personal knowledge. And the first thing in any path, whether you're a Wiccan, whether you're a Thelemite, whether you're a Sedian, the first thing involved is finding out who you are and then what the cosmos is, and then finally, how do those pieces fit together?
Mm-hmm. So what led you to the left path, left-hand path? What before you got there, where were you?
Well, for many years, I mean, I had been a practitioner of sort of loosely defined neo-shamanic magic. Like many people that grew up in the 70s and 80s, I was vastly influenced by the novels of Carlos Castaneda, which I read, of course, at the time as being nonfiction books. And I had a vague sense of drawing energy from and interacting with the natural world. But it never became a particularly evolved practice. And what led me into the left-hand path was an unusual route. Way back in 1988, I'm a science fiction and horror writer, as you had mentioned. I had received an invitation to write a short story for an anthology about the Salem witch trials. And, you know, they contacted me and they said, you know, what do you know about the Salem witch trials? And like any writer, immediately I said, oh, I'm an expert. And of course went the next day to the library, because in those days you actually went places to get information. Mm-hmm. And so I had been researching for a day the Salem witch trials, and I made a schema for myself that showed how the witch trials progressed. How it began with the sort of vague accusations, how at one point people were saying dreams are valid evidence, hysteria, why most of the people that were accused were women, and usually women with large estates that could be taken over by the witch court, oftentimes not mentioned. And so I made a timeline, and I wrote it down, and I had worked, you know, hard all day, and it was near Halloween. And I said, you know, I've worked enough today. And I turned on the TV, and it was Geraldo Rivera's special, Satanism in America. Very dramatic. There was this huge, swirling black Baphomet that jumped out of the screen, and there was, you know, swirling noise. We turned on, and there were a series of so-called experts speaking on Satanism, saying all these outlandish urban folktales. Mm-hmm. And I picked up my timeline since it was sitting next to me, and I got a flared pen, and I started marking off, hey, that happened. So I filled out this entire timeline and said, hey, all this is still going on 300 years later. Boy, we have not learned anything as a species. Mm-hmm. And I was about to leave the show when this one enormous occult expert, I get this guy weighed about 400 pounds on the hoof, said, Geraldo, you would not believe the amount of blood these people use in their ceremonies. Gallons and gallons of blood. But I have located the name of every single Satanist in America. And then one of the guests, in a very calm voice, said, well, as a law officer, why aren't you arresting them? And immediately, of course, the guy had nothing to say because he had been called out. Mm-hmm. And camera cut to Geraldo, who had this look like, I don't know, that's like a reasonable question. So he cuts to a commercial immediately. And I thought, wow, that guy is amazing. And the guy was a lieutenant colonel named Michael A. Aquino. And he was the founder and then high priest of the Temple of Set. The next night, I went to a party with some friends of mine. And at the party, I just said, you know, I've never sent a fan letter to someone on TV, but if I could send a note to that Aquino guy, I would. Because that he put Geraldo in his place. It was the only reasonable thing said in 90 minutes of TV. Mm-hmm. One person at the party really gave me the stink eye. And I thought, oh no, I've offended her in some way. At the end of the party, she walks up to me and she says, you're driving me home tonight. And I said, sure, of course. So I figured she was going to tell me, you know, why this was a bad human or the errors of my thinking. We get out in the car and she says to me, do you really want to send a letter to Dr. Aquino? And I was really surprised at the word doctor because it had not been used in the broadcast. Mm-hmm. Yeah. She said, well, I'm seeing him next week at the International Conclave of the Temple of Set in Toronto. I can deliver it for you.
Oh.
Now, this was a strange moment because all of the occultists I had met in my life up to that moment were, frankly, a couple of tacos short of a combination plate. You know, they had to wear tons of cheap occult jewelry. All they could talk about was their occult experience, and they usually didn't have a good job and oftentimes kind of smelled of patchouli. Mm-hmm. And someone that had a really good job, and she was really smart, and her husband was a professor at the University of Texas. And I said, yeah, that would be great. And so I went home and I wrote a letter. And I complimented him on putting Geraldo in his place. And then I wrote at the very end, I said, I have looked at what I could find about the Temple of Set. There's not much information out there. And you say you're a group that promotes individuality. I don't understand how a group can promote individualism. That seems to be an inherent paradox. And I sent the letter off. And then I got back a letter from Dr. Aquino in a couple of weeks, printed on his green beret stationery. And, you know, he thanked me for his letter. And he said, at the very end of the letter, just tossed off the line, says, you know, we haven't understood the individual group thing ourselves. Maybe you should join and explain it to us. Mm. Which I thought was a really flippant remark.
Mm-hmm.
But it somehow intrigued me in a different way. It wasn't the, we're the one true path, you should join us, I see that you're one of us, or you know, any of those kind of conjuncts. You're an old soul and you belong here. And so with great hesitancy, because at that time we were the beginning of what America called the Satanic Panic, and people were looking at satanic groups with really critical eyes, as a lot of urban folklore formerly attached to witchcraft was now attached to Satanism. But I sent off my membership and I joined. And I received their introductory packet and I read their philosophy. And I looked at their reading list, which in those days I think was about 300 volumes. And some things like the collected works of Plato. This is not the average occult organization. And I began writing. I began acting in, you know, learning to do ritual, learning the methodology. And within 7 years, I was the next high priest. I was Dr. Quino's successor.
Wow.
It was a case of finding the language that I need. One of the things that, and I'm sure your listeners have had this experience, when you reach the right level of development, the correct teacher will appear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that person shouldn't ask anything of you other than just saying, work hard, and here's a language system you can work in. And you usually know pretty soon, is this the place I want to be? So that was how I came to the left-hand path, and in particular into the Temple of Set.
Oh, you were supposed to be there. I mean, you know, some people would join and not move up and up and up and up, and, you know, you did. And that means you were in the right place. Absolutely.
I think so.
So how does the left-hand path differ in the 21st century than in years gone by? Because, you know, all paths change according to the times. And so has it been different maybe from 20, 30 years ago until now?
Absolutely. I've seen two major changes. Number one, 30 years ago, a large number of people that sought us out needed therapy for some bad experience they had had in a Christian faith, usually a fundamentalist faith. And it was very liberating for them to make fun of that and very healing for them. But they weren't truly seeking any form of self-development other than that. They would come in, they would stay a few years, they would leave. Now it tends to be a bit more serious seekers, probably because there's a lot more information about us out in the world. Mm-hmm. The second thing is there's a normal maturation of what's called a new religion. When new religious movements start, a lot of the members tend to be people who are not well socially integrated. They tend to be people who don't have a college education, who are running their own business, who have a strong independent streak, and are very willing to try new things. As a new religion develops and people say, hey, this is staying around for a few years and it's continuing to produce quality graduates, then you tend to see more of the people that have more of a social stake involved trying it out. So I think I tend to see fewer people coming in now that are angry 19-year-olds and more people coming in now that are 30-year-old seekers that have tried a few different systems and have some thought under their belt. And personally, I think that's really helped deepen our practice.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people, as with, you know, people that want to be a witch, they want it just because they want to walk around with the title on their foreheads. And, you know, they don't care. They don't know. They don't want to learn. You know, it's like thrill seekers almost.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's a moment of relief, and that's a good thing. You know, because anything that breaks you from the hypnosis of society is usually a good thing. But then a lot of people don't have anywhere to go with that. You know, that's like someone that says, my quest is personal immortality. But if they're confronted with a Sunday rainy afternoon, they don't know what to do with themselves. I mean, the worst thing they could get would be thousands of years of consciousness because they can't amuse themselves for hours.
Well, people have very short attention spans, too. I mean, you know, one day they're this way, and it's like a gnat, you know. You think about one thing, and then, boom, you go to the next and jumping from back and forth, and it's crazy. I'm just looking here in the book because you were talking, somebody asked a question under the frequently asked questions thing, and it kind of proved the point that you were saying, but let me just find it because I don't want to misquote it. Because it was about, you know, people that reading the book, everybody, are you trying to get everybody to come over to the left-hand path and into the church? Okay.
Well, absolutely not. In fact, it's fairly difficult to join the Temple of SETI. It's about a two-year process. And I would like to think maybe the smartest, most gifted people who say, wow, everything in that book works for me, might seek us out. But I'm also hoping that these are a lot of technologies that a lot of people can use to just sort of better their lives. Mm-hmm. I really don't want to funnel in members, and we've always kind of kept small numbers purposefully. So we've kind of avoided being a mass movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, your response was, God's no, you know. But I also, I was really laughing at your answers for some of these frequently asked questions, because there was this, the other one about the person said that they were a member of a local vampire group, and their leader was a 500-year-old vampire, and says that all he needed is for them to give him sex, blood, money, attention, and he doesn't teach any of this stuff that you're talking about. And you know, and so he asked, why should you do this? And I love your answer. You said, by all means, follow him. He's clearly more advanced than me, you know, 500 years. So, I mean, it's good that you have a really good sense of humor with this. And it seems like you have a good tolerance to people that are maybe foolish or just whatever, right? I don't know how to put it politely.
There are a lot of people who are so caught up in the romantic notions they have, mm-hmm. Because we all have that at some point.
Yeah,
you know, we're all young and foolish, and you should keep a certain amount of being young and foolish your whole life. It's just finding the right amount, mm-hmm. and so that they are caught up with. And so, unfortunately, there are people who will say, "Hey, you can project all of your romantic notions on me," because that is a vampire act. You're accepting their energy, but it's not an ethical act.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're going to lie and say, I am this thing or this thing. And then what's going to happen, of course, to these people, it'll be this terrible moment when they realize, oh my God, I spent 5 years of my life, you know, giving all this energy and maybe money and maybe sexual favors to this person. And so, you know, if you're in any kind of religious group and they're wanting anything that you don't want to give them, particularly sex and money, then that's not a good group. That's a scary thing to be in.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, there's always a certain degree of predators in any profession.
Right.
I mean, yes, there are certainly predators in the occult world, but there's predators that are Christian youth ministers too.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a sad thing about our society. There are a small group of humans when they discover that they're a little more awake and a little more powerful than other humans, believe that's a license to do whatever they want.
Yeah.
And that's just becoming a worse human. Maybe more empowered, but definitely a worse human.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there are a lot of sheep in this world that humans are, and will follow anything that sounds good without thinking first about it. So, anyway, that's a soapbox question, a soapbox thing. But let's talk about the book. It's an initiatory guide, and it takes the reader through a 9-month process of initiation by using practices such as guided magical techniques, manifestation methods, experiments to utilize the energy that the reader, you know, learns to gather and store. And, you know, people are eclectic practitioners. They take bits and pieces of other paths to create their own special path. And I think that's a really good thing because, you know, nobody's path is going to be 100% generally, you know, what you want to follow. So it's good to take bits and pieces of it. But you said that while becoming a vampire is far from something that you can just dabble in, because it's a lifestyle, basically, there are bits and pieces and practices that people from other paths should take, right?
absolutely. I mean, I set the book up in four parts. And the first part, which I call vampire-like, is I give people some of the basic techniques, and some of them are quite powerful, and say, here's what this is, go use it. If it works for you, if it is bringing you happiness and enlightenment and better health, or whatever your criteria are, then the second part, which is a rather in-depth initiatory path, that might be for you. You know, I buy before you fly, I guess. But the third part, then, I deal with something that generally isn't talked about in occult manuals, which is, okay, you've become an initiate. What now? Mm-hmm. Talk about adulting. Like, what does it mean when I've been an initiate for 20 years? You know, and it's not something that I'm doing my first ritual. Mm-hmm. And the last part of the book is just a collection of resources that I think will be useful for people that are practitioners. So it's almost a miscellany that goes with the first three parts.
Mm-hmm. And in reading through it, I mean, it's not just something that you take lightly. And as I said before, it's a lifestyle, but it's an ongoing work. Daily, weekly, monthly, yearly, there's things that must be done. And it's like there's no rest, but it's always to help grow, right?
Well, there can be rest. And in fact, if we look at the vampiric archetype, if we look at the vampire that we see in novels and films, they spend a large amount of their time resting, right? They spend, half their time sleeping in a coffin somewhere. And this is an important notice because the vampire is out in an exciting, energetic world half the time, and then half the time their vampiric powers are turned off. And you need to understand how to structure your rest so that it's very secure. Just as in the myth, the vampire will usually have some human servitor that's out there, making sure that the coffin is safe or something. Mm-hmm. You should have among your friends, and most importantly, train yourself to take care of yourself when you're at rest. Because you have to balance the excitement of sort of predatory, highly sensuous vampiric life with everyday life. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't want to be a vampire in your full enhanced senses when you're dealing with getting your plumbing fixed.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes. Got it. One more quick question before we take the break. We've got a couple of minutes. There was a chat room question that said, what's the difference between the spelling of the word vampire in your book cover, which is with a Y instead of the I? And that's a good question because I was also thinking that we should quickly go through the neck-biting, blood-sucking stereotype and explain that that's not what you're all about.
I chose that for a couple of reasons. One, of course, the first vampire novel in English by Dr. John Polidori used that spelling, so it has a great piece of tradition. Mm-hmm. But I do want to emphasize that, no, we are not blood-drinking, coffin-sleeping, crucifix-fearing creatures. And in fact, the odd spelling is beginning to point out you have to be conscious while you're doing this. There are people in the world that are totally unconsciously vampiric. They're psychic vampires. You've met these people.
Mm-hmm.
You spend 10 minutes with them, you feel about a quart low.
Yep.
But they're not making a conscious choice to be that way. They don't walk away saying, ha-ha, I've got something. They're just the walking wounded. Yeah. Whereas the vampire has made a conscious choice, so I use the somewhat more romantic spelling with a Y.
Yeah, I've always liked that. I mean, it just reminds me of ye olde English. But, I'm sure that when people see this book right off the bat, and that's why I wanted to bring it up, it's not Count Dracula. Vampire, it's a whole different thing. But it's like, the same thing witches go through. We eat little children and we cackle all day around the cauldron and, all that stuff. So people need to be enlightened about stereotypes, because they usually don't fit, or they're partially fit, but they're not really totally correct. It's just, you have to learn and ask questions to get to the base of what you really want to know, right?
No, a person is not his or her mask.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to know why you use a mask as a tool.
Yeah.
Or the mask is losing you.
Well, either, yeah, if you let it, it certainly will. All right, well, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about energy, methods of gathering it, and a whole lot more. So everybody stay with us, and we'll be back in about 2 minutes.
Don't go away. There's more Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks right after these important messages.
Kimberly Juarez with Cat Paranormal of Minnesota.
Hi, I'm Willow Lehman Shine, psychic medium, Dark Nola Paranormal, New Orleans.
And I'm Jerry Ayers with Supernatural Investigators of Minnesota. And together, we are The Calling. Every Wednesday night, 7 p.m. Central Standard Time and 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, only on ParaXRadioNetwork.com.
Hi, this is Marla Brooks from Stirring the Cauldron. Thursdays are a great night on the ParaX Radio Network. On the first and third Thursdays of the month at 8 p.m., it's Tango and Friends, hosted by Bruce Tango. And on the alternate Thursdays at 8 p.m., tune in to Stirring the Cauldron, the archive podcast. Every week at 9 p.m. Eastern, join me on Stirring the Cauldron Live. And then at 10 p.m., stick around for New Aeon Now with Lily Alley, Davron Michaels, and Christine Matza. Finally, to round out the night, join Dr. Kelly Renee Schutz on the Paranormal Encounters podcast. All this, every Thursday, right here on ParaX.
Missed an episode of Stirring the Cauldron? Then be sure to check out MarlaBrooks.com and check out the archive. And while you're there, check out Marla's weekly Witch's Oracle card reading. Explore the site to find many great resources, such as information on tarot, oracle readings, metaphysical consultations, and links to all of Marla's books. That's MarlaBrooks.com. Welcome back to Stirring the Cauldron. Once again, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
My guest tonight is Don Webb. He's the author of Energy Magic of the Vampire. So let's jump into the topic of energy and start off with defining energy, because it just isn't the feeling you get when you down a Red Bull or a cup of coffee. There are many different types of energy used in a variety of ways, right?
Well, there are many different types of energy. Now, every human, if you were to ask them, you know what energy is, they'll immediately say yes, because that's one of those things we have this innate knowledge of, but then we don't think a lot about what it is. Now, one thing that I've noticed after years of practice, and you know, I first addressed this years ago in my book, Uncle Set Knox, Essential Guide to the Left-Hand Path, there are different flavors of energy in a person. There's physical energy, the energy that you may feel if you are having a great diet and you're doing your exercise program, you're eating well. There's energy of an emotional nature that certain circumstances can bring you. Now, sometimes it can be extreme energy, like being sexually attracted to someone, or it can be an energy because you have a big scare. That fills you with a lot of energy. There's intellectual energy. You read something interesting. You work out a difficult problem. There's even spiritual energies that I'm sure your listeners have encountered out in the world or during various rituals. One of the things the vampire can do is they can take in any of these energies and transform them into any of the other categories. So, for example, it is within the scope of vampiric magic to say, man, my health is not good, but I'm reading this really great book and I'm thinking about it, to literally take that intellectual energy and apply it to healing yourself. The vampire becomes aware of the different energies flowing through his or her body and can decide where those go. Now, as humans, we are trained by society to do certain things with our energy. We have a lot of social programming. Now, some of that is very good. I like the fact that everybody I meet on the street has been trained to stop at a stop sign. That is a good thing. But there's other ways we've been trained to deal with our energy that has nothing to do with us. For example, if I were to sing, well, hum, I guess, the McDonald's theme song, you would immediately think of McDonald's. Wow, the McDonald's Corporation has real estate in your brain. That's a big deal.
Yeah.
Now, there's a lot of energy that we're forced, and it's easy to manipulate energy, as we've seen in the last, say, 6-7 years of American politics. American politics have descended to a level of high emotion, where whatever your point of view is, I can say just a few words, and I can make you suddenly very angry, or I can make you suddenly extremely happy. Wow. That's programming that we probably didn't volunteer to accept. The vampire becomes very aware of not only how energy flows, but what may be controlling the energy around them. Now, the best way we do this, the gift that is the best part of the book, I give out for free, and I'm even going to give it out tonight and without buying the book. The best thing you can do every night, sometime before you go to sleep, is just do an energy inventory of the day. What made you feel good or powerful or strong or alert? And what made you feel tired or hopeless or depressed? You don't even have to deal with that for a while. Just for a few days, start discovering these things. And the first thing you'll discover is you're engaged in a lot of things that make you feel bad that you don't have to be engaged in. There's really no reason to do that. You'll discover that there are certain places you go that the energy level is always low. Now, that may be for a completely objective, normal reason, like the ionization of the air is bad or the lighting is terrible. But then, are you having to go there? A lot of things we put in the modern world, like, for example, fluorescent lights, have a known bad effect on the human neural system. But they're cheap, so we keep using them. But that doesn't mean you have to go and expose yourself. And you'll discover who brings you joy and who drains your energy. And you might just ask yourself, why am I not spending more time with the people that bring me joy?
Mm-hmm. That makes good sense. The other thing that really is interesting to me, and I want to talk about it, is gathering energy and the fact that we can store it in the body, in artifacts, in talisman, and in groups of people, egregores. I think there are various ways people use energy, as creating energy balls, for example. But rather than store it, they make it happen, and then they use it right away. So can you talk about some of the gathering methods and then how to store some of it?
Okay, I'll give you a couple of methods that are really useful. Number one, let's say that you have a physical routine. You run every day, or you practice yoga every day, or you take nature walks. There's going to be a time during your physical routine you feel really strong. You feel the blood pumping through your system. Here's a really simple technique. Close your eyes. Take a few deep, calm breaths, and just tell yourself, I am storing this energy in my body. It seems to be a subjective statement, but you will discover, if you practice this even for a week, suddenly you can get that second wind that people need, you know, in the afternoon when usually they go off and pour caffeine into themselves. But that's a really simple thing, but it makes you aware of the fact the energy is not merely something that's temporary in your body. Now, on a deeper level, storing energy in an artifact. If you're going through something really meaningful in your life, it's a great time to journal or to do art or to make a record that can come back to you and give you that energy back. Here's something that every human has going on. At some point in our lives, we become sexually aware and sexually active. How much active, I'm not going to go into that. Maybe a little, maybe a lot. But during that time, all these things in life seem so sweet. The songs on the radio, the TV shows we're watching, the clothes we're wearing. Guess what? You have imparted energy to all of those things. And you can, in fact, go and get the songs of your late teenage years and play them and feel better. You did that without any training at all, because it's a normal human function. The vampire just kicks that up a notch. A lot of vampires know the importance of vampiric jewelry. Now, it shouldn't be something that's hokey and cheesy and going to scare your friends. It doesn't have to be a silver bat on a chain. But let's say you do have a necklace that you wear when you go clubbing or when you interact with people and you're drawing energy in. That can become a talisman. At the end of the night, put it in your left hand, feel the energy going into it. It's a battery. And you know, you may need that sometime when you're doing a particularly important piece of work or you're sending a really deep wish out into the world. Now, if you associate with other vampires, there can be things where you can create an egregore. You can give a name to your group, and you can willfully say, we're going to feed this group, let's say, every Wednesday, or whatever is mythically resonant for you. And that energy stays there, but I can draw on it when I want to. And in the meantime, it can do things like bring new people to our group, or give us better luck in our jobs, or help us find small things in the world. With any kind of magic like that, early on, test it. See if it's doing something. Don't just simply assume it's there, because you'll get techniques that work better for you. Now, some of the techniques that go into egregore making, I learned because my magic teacher had all of the magical papers of the Fraternitas Saturni, a long-standing German occult organization. So I learned some techniques pretty early on. But you can also find your own techniques. Experimenting is the heart of magic. Magic is an experimental art and an experimental science.
Well, I think a lot of people that listen to my show regularly do know about egregores because I had Mark Stavish on, and we did a whole show on them and kind of, you know, introduced them to people.
No, I really like Mark. Mark is, although we differ in a lot of political views, Mark is unfailingly a cordial gentleman and is deeply, deeply knowledgeable.
Yes, he is.
I also noticed that one of the people listening to the middle of the show that you have there on the network is Lily Alley. Could you say hi to her next time you see her? She is a real sweetheart.
I certainly will. She's on right after I am. So, okay. Yeah, I will pass it on tonight, actually. Okay, so the other thing, one of the vampiric precepts is, it says it's better to exchange energy than merely take it. Can you elaborate on that?
Absolutely, and I'm glad you asked about that one. You see, the vampire should not be a simple predator going out and stealing energy where he or she may. Okay, you can do that to protect yourself. That's great. You can do that if you have health needs or whatever. Fine, good. But the best thing you can do is find someone else with a little bit of the vampiric gift and learn to exchange energy back and forth rapidly. Now, you've already had this happen in your life. You know someone that if you go spend an hour with them, you both walk away with more energy. You have that friend that you know when you are down in the dumps. If I call him or her, or we go out for coffee, we both feel better, our luck improves. That's a vampiric exchange. You have both passed energy to each other. You've used your own filtering, refining, exalting system, and you give it back freely. The vampire just becomes more aware of this process and can do it at will. The vampire then always seems to be charming or seductive or mysterious. And because of that, nice things happen to them. I'll give you a really minor example of vampiric power. Okay. A few weeks ago, I was on a panel with three other writers. Two of them were much better known, much more famous guys than me. And then one of them was this younger writer, and she was drop-dead gorgeous. Mm-hmm. All talking, and it was a hot room. The AC wasn't working well. Somebody got up, went and got a glass of ice water, brought it to me. Not one of my fans, not someone I knew, but because my vampiric presence was actually working on them. Because the thing you would think is they're going to go to the famous person, or they're going to go to the really attractive person. The vampiric presence exchanges energy with everybody. And then I had a moment of exchange as I took the water from my hand, and I gave them a vampiric glance. And suddenly they also felt this little wave of energy. Now, they had no idea they were part of an occult operation. In fact, that might even scare the hell out of them. So we just go around telling people, hey, you know, I'm putting the woogie on you. But it's a really useful way to know when and where to exchange energy.
Mm-hmm. And I was going to ask you about the vampire gaze that I was reading about in the book. It sounded really nice. It sounded interesting. Talk about it.
The vampire gaze is the easiest way to gain energy. It's largely just holding someone's eye contact. Here's the simplest way. When you're talking to someone that you want to have exchange with, do the following. Look away for a moment, 2 seconds. Close your eyes. Picture a horned crescent moon extending through your head. And the reason you do that is by picturing this, your irises are going to get larger. And that's a sign that you're aroused or interested. Look back at the person, look directly at them, and now your eyes have a real shine, so they're going to look, because they don't understand what's going on, but they're getting the cue, hey, this person's turned on by me, and then match their breathing. Just go in sync with their breathing. Suddenly, that sends a deep message to the other person that they're in total rapport with you, and that will cause them to unlock their own energy sources. It will cause them to drop their defenses. And at that moment, because you're willing this encounter, both you and they feel better. If they're particularly sensitive, it even feels seductive or warm. Or if you're an old fart like me, you just suddenly seem to be a charming old man.
Mm. Okay, I've got 2 questions from the chat room, and I think one kind of piggybacks the other. What is the distance that energy can be exchanged? And the second question is, can you distance transmission like with Reiki?
Yes, of course, we're both. Now, the distance that energy can be exchanged depends on your intimacy and familiarity with the person that you're having an exchange with. My mentor in the Order of the Vampire was the Grand Master of the Order, Lilith Aquino. And Lilith Aquino and I could have a phone call tonight, even though she's in San Francisco and I'm here in slightly stormy Austin. And immediately that exchange will start. I couldn't, however, just pick a random person in San Francisco and say, okay, you and I are going to exchange energy. It is based on either proximity, they're in the same room with you, or intimacy. They have some ties with you. And yes, you can, in fact, direct energy flow into various places. I do have a friend in the order who is a professional masseuse, and he can lay his hand on your back, and you will feel every single muscle relax. Mm-hmm. Because he has learned to connect that. In fact, he does have a Reiki practice. We've connected these two techniques into one. That's a really sharp question, whoever asked that.
Mm-hmm. We have a sharp chat room. We really do. I'm very grateful for that. All right. So how important is magic in your practice? Because I was reading that it is important. And also I was reading about the color and flavors of magic. And that was really interesting.
Well, magic is the art of changing your subjective universe, what's inside you, so deeply it causes a proportional change in the outside universe. Now, any act can be magical once you've learned how to do magic. It does not have to be done through incantations and side jewels and burning the right incense at the right time. Those things are training wheels. And they're really good at one point. You know, you can't start without them. But you want to be able to perform a magical working while you're riding in a bus downtown, because you've learned how to change what's going on in your own universe. Now, there's a lot of ideas about magic. Can you hear the terminology white and black magic? Usually determined that white magic is good, like us, and black magic is what them other people do. But white magic is a magic of submission. You find a larger body, a larger egregore, a larger deity, and you say, hey, take over. I'm giving you my energy. I just need you to handle this. Anyone can do white magic. It does not require skill. It just requires emotion.
Mm-hmm.
Black magic is consciously working magic on yourself to improve yourself. Now, I'm going to divert to two separate categories here. And there's a lot of terminology for this, so I'm just going to use my own terminology. There's sorcery. Sorcery is, I do something, it affects the world, but I don't get better. Sorcery is okay. Sorcery is great. I want to use sorcery to have good travel bookings for my next trip. Okay, so I'll write a couple of runes and burn them. Done. But I'm not changed. I have not improved. Magic is that art of improving yourself. Because if I've improved myself, better things will happen to me. Think about trying to earn someone's love through magic. I could do sorcery on them and make them think they love me. And there's any number of spells and any number of traditions that work for that. Or I could do magic on myself to make myself more desirable,
mm-hmm.
which is the better choice. And I say making myself more desirable is the better choice, because as anyone that's a magical practitioner for years knows, sometimes you'll put a love spell on someone, they will fall in love with you, and you've done a terrible thing.
Yeah, absolutely terrible thing.
I could literally feel your listeners nodding all through Radio Land at that moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I'm sorry, I was just looking at a question in chat, because she said, I think it's about, relates to the gaze in a sense. It says, looking at a person, I tend to look at the forehead and tune into the third eye. Am I fooling myself?
I could answer that yes or no. The important thing is you have a model of humans that tells you that the most important area of their body is this area between the two hemispheres of their brain, where the pineal gland is. And we're back when we were three-eyed lizards about, 90 million years ago. It was pretty important. But the fact you believe this, and most likely they believe this, means, of course, this works. Plus, the vampiric gaze is much stronger because you seem to be looking into them. You're actually directing your attention to the inner person. Now, in that sense, you're not fooling yourself. In the sense of, is that the seat of the soul? Probably not. You know, the energies of ourself is all around. That's the one our civilization and our culture says right now. If you were an ancient Egyptian, let's say you were living in the time of Ramesses II, you would know the seat of the soul is right in the middle of the chest, and the head is pretty useless, which is why when they mummified people, they would take the brain out and throw it away, because they just want to deal with the important parts.
Mm-hmm.
Were they more right than us? No, probably not. But as long as it's everyone's belief, then that's very effective.
Mm-hmm. That's true. All right. Now, sometimes I ask an author who should read their book. But today I'm going to ask you who should not read your book, because when a book begins with a warning to the readers, it's not all lollipops and butterflies, right? So who is this? Who did you write the book for, and who might be better steering clear of it?
All right. The book, first off, is written for adults. It's written for someone who, they may not be truly adulted yet, but they are at least legally an adult, because it involves using a lot of practices that can bring up emotions and memories and strong sensations in the body. The book should not be read or utilized by someone who's going through psychological trauma. magic can be used to heal trauma, and if you're doing that, you probably need to be working with someone who can kind of check you out because they've been there before. Vampiric magic is about getting energy. Pouring energy into a situation does not necessarily make the situation better, it just makes it more energetic. Vampiric magic should be used by someone who has a generally stable life, not a perfectly stable life, and who's beginning to explore what their goals and objectives are. Because magic will get you quicker, vampiric magic will get you to your goals and objectives both more quickly and with a greater sense of, we say, naughty fun getting there.
Just a quick note, Lily Alley is in the house, and she says she loves you and you're an awesome man.
Thank you. The feelings, although with a different gender pronoun, would be exactly what I would say about her.
Okay, good. All right, well, we're really running out of time. So this is a very comprehensive book that we only scratched the surface of. So do you have a website or wherever people can go and find out more about you, the book, and all the rest?
I don't have a website. I mean, I have, you know, my Wikipedia page is what it is. Mm-hmm. There, I'm going to have something on the Inner Traditions book blog next week that talks about some of the techniques. So that would be the best thing. And then, of course, obviously you can get the book through Amazon. If you decide you're not interested in the occult side of vampires, I also have a collection of vampiric fiction called The Velvet of Vampires that a lot of people go and decide that's what they want to read. So I'm cool with that, too.
Yeah, you've written so many books. It was amazing. I kept seeing, well, somebody said, there's this and this and this, and then you're writing, you know, for UCLA also. So, wow, you got a lot going on your plate. But thank you so much for joining me tonight, because you saved a little room for us, and I really appreciate it. And please come back anytime you feel like you want to.
Thank you so much. I've thoroughly enjoyed the program. Clearly, you have some pretty sharp listeners. So this was a really well-spent night.
Well, good. I'm glad. And let's thank those listeners as well. And until next time, everybody, blessed be, and merry meet again. Good night.
Good night.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks. Please join us again next week at the same time for another great guest and more cauldron stirring. Any rebroadcast or other use of this program without explicit permission is strictly prohibited.